Hi, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. With our colleagues at the Baltimore Brew, today we begin a new series, the Accountability Index. We'll take a hard look at public spending and public servants, and we'll ask, how much are we spending and why? This morning, two city road projects are turning out to be a lot more expensive than they were supposed to be. Mark Reuter has written extensively about it, and we'll ask him, who's minding the store? Plus, the monthly Movie Mayhem with Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday and the pianists Bashara Haroni and Yaron Kohlberg. They're a Palestinian and an Israeli who play all over the world together. They join me in Studio A in advance of their concert in Owings Mills tomorrow night. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Nathan's got the news. First, NPR has this hour's headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Hey, good morning, everybody, on this partially foggy Friday morning. Glad to have you with us on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Mark Reuter from the Baltimore Brew joins me this morning here in Studio A. If you're not familiar with it, the Brew is an online news source that focuses on local issues. Mark and his colleagues at the Brew will stop by Maryland Morning from time to time for a series that we're going to call the Accountability Index. Much of the Brew's reporting has to do with holding local and state officials accountable for a variety of taxpayer expenditures, and our hope is that we'll be able to zero in on certain projects and explore how public money is being spent to find out simply if we're getting our money's worth. We'll also explore accountability as it relates to policy. For example, did you know that last month during the City Council committee hearing on whether or not to appoint Kevin Davis as the permanent police commissioner, Charm TV, the cable access channel that broadcasts City Council meetings, went off the air for about 5 minutes during the time that police were escorting protesters and some news media out of the council chamber. So anyone watching the proceedings of that meeting on TV did not see that part of it. When the council committee resumed its agenda after the protesters were cleared from the room, the TV channel went back on the air. We will look into that with our Brew colleagues on a future edition of the Accountability Index, but today we want to talk to Mark Reuter about a couple of road projects and the system of granting contracts for this kind of work. Morning, Mark. Good to see you.
Well, good to see you.
So you've been looking into this for quite a while now. There are two in particular that you wrote about. Your most recent story just appeared online on the Brew yesterday afternoon. Let's talk about the scope of the problem, and we'll start with the road resurfacing that they're doing in Roland Park on Roland Avenue, kind of around where Eddie's supermarket is down to like Cold Spring Lane. What's going on up there?
What's going on there is it was a road repaving streetscape project, been in the works for years. Over the summer, the city's contractor put in a new pavement, but the curbs were too low or the pavement was too high. That's unsure. But the net result is that this $3 million project was really inadequate. Residential houses and others were being flooded every time it rained from rainwater that was pouring out of the street. There were not sufficient storm drains. And we started getting involved in the story in September and found out that the city's solution was to hire the same contractor who did this, pay them allegedly, they said, under $1 million to redo all the curbing. And that has since progressed to where we find out, and I wrote about yesterday, that the price tag is not $900,000, but is now over $2 million with the latest addition approved by the mayor and Board of Estimates on Wednesday.
And this is an additional $2
million.
This is over and above what the project originally
what
cost.
What seemed like a very straightforward project, in their own words, a simple shave and pave is what they call it, meaning you shave off the surface and repave it, is now 55% or over $2 million over the original low bid. And it still has 4 or 5 months to go, and the road is still a mess, as anyone traveling along it will see.
We're going to talk about one as well in a little bit over on Dundalk Avenue. But between these two projects, they were originally priced at about $18 million. They're currently at $28 million.
Right.
So it's $10 million bucks, more expensive than projected. I spoke with Kathy Dominick from the Department of Transportation yesterday. She's a spokeswoman. And I asked her, how is it that they could do a whole thing and then have to rip up the curb that they had put in and put in a new curb? I mean, it seems like that could have been anticipated, the fact that they were going to have flooding. And she basically said that, these things happen. They were not able to anticipate that. She suggested that the new asphalt is less porous than the old asphalt. Therefore, when the rain falls on that asphalt, it does not seep into the ground the way it used to, and it ended up seeping into people's yards. The other thing is how long these projects are taking. She expects that the Dundalk Avenue streetscape is going to be completed by the end of this month, but this Roland Avenue project, which we're talking about now, may not be completed until sometime in the spring.
That's correct.
Is this the kind of thing that an engineer from the Department of Transportation could have, should have anticipated? Because the contractor is going to say, or has said, that we're simply building this thing to the specs that we were given. And so they were given a curb height and an asphalt height, and they built it. And then it turns out it didn't work, so they had to rip it up and do it all over again.
Well, on both of these cases, the Dundalk Avenue one is really interesting. Dundalk Avenue, from Eastern Avenue to the city line, or a little under a mile, has been under reconstruction. This month, it will be entering its third year. It, too, has had a 55% cost increase. And in that case, the city repaved the northbound lanes of Dundalk around a year and a half ago, and then, oops, they found out that the subsurface was cracked. They then ripped out everything, and another year plus has transpired. And the project is still not done. It's really fascinating. The Board of Estimates had mention of this project on Wednesday, 2 days ago, and said that the project would be extended till the end of this year, strictly due to administrative reasons, and that the contractor has completed the work. We went out yesterday for this story in the rain down in Dundalk, and there was construction, road barricades and barriers throughout the length of Dundalk Avenue. The work clearly is not completed.
And again, the spokesperson for the DOT yesterday said that she expects it to be completed this month. I mean, did it look like they could get it knocked off by, Thanksgiving or the end of the week?
I can't really say there, but,
Yeah.
I wanted to say, Tom, that there's a really important policy issue here in how the city works and what we've really emphasized. And it's an acronym. It's a three-letter acronym that all city taxpayers should learn and start appreciating. It's called EWOs. EWO is an extra work order. And it is through EWOs that these projects start escalating in price from their original bid. The original bid is a low bid in this case, and the city gives the contract typically to the lowest bidder. But lo and behold, we find consistently in our reporting for the Brew that a year, 6 months, 9 months later, a series of EWOs come up on these contracts. And this is what's happening here. These EWOs are approved by the five-member Board of Estimates, headed by the mayor and city council president, Jack Young. For the 5 years I've covered this, they have never had a discussion about a single EWO, and we're talking collectively over $100 million, and it usually is approved without comment under a routine agenda.
They've never turned one down, as far as you can remember.
No, they have not.
And when it comes to this stuff, for example, the EWO that's given to the construction company that's doing the Roland Avenue project, it's called the M. Luis Construction Company, they get more than $1 million of extra money to fix what they weren't able to complete, correctly the first time. Where's that money come from? And doesn't that money, you write in your story that money gets diverted from other projects that the city badly needs to address.
These larger roadway projects, these two roads are around 80% federally funded. So around 20% of the money comes directly from the general fund that our property taxes go into. So much of the money, 80%, comes from federal, but there's a limited pot of federal money. And so they are diverting this money which is part of the EWO process from other much-needed projects. One example is the Hartford Road Bridge. The city knows that that bridge on Hartford Road crossing Herring Run is a mess. For 20 years, they've talked about rebuilding it. For the last 10 years, they have said that they would have bids and start the process. That road and bridge is still not gotten underway because of lack of funds. Edmondson Avenue Bridge in West Baltimore is another example of a badly deteriorated piece of infrastructure where the federal money is not going there. In part, we know because it's going to fix these previous projects that seem to endlessly never get done.
And is this the kind of thing, I mean, anybody who's ever renovated an old house, you know, is familiar with getting bids from various contractors and stuff. You say that the lowest bid often gets the job.
Yes.
But then there are all these EWOs, these extra work orders that pile up on top of it. When you look into these extra work orders, what about the transparency when it comes to finding out where they come from and, you know, how much are given out? Is it easy to get this information?
No, it's almost impossible to get that information. For example, Roland Avenue, the EWOs have, besides the actual numbers where it's almost like reading a little specialized account. You have to figure out how these numbers work, but it's decipherable, a little bit hieroglyphic. There's typically one sentence that very generally just says for use in dealing with drainage problems. Very, very vague. Now, the city's statement there is, oh, if you want more information, the public or the press, you have to file a PIA, public information request, with the agency. In the case of the Roland Avenue, the BRU submitted a PIA request for information on the road, the inspection, how this all got into the situation it is now on September 13th. And almost 2 months has passed, and the city DOT has not supplied a word back.
All right. We will check in with you again about this and many other stories that you're working on at the BRU. Mark Reuter, good to see you. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed this.
Mark Reuter is a reporter at the Baltimore BRU. It's a daily news website featuring investigative reporting and informed commentary about Baltimore and the region. He's been reporting in this area since 1970. He was a longtime reporter for the Baltimore Sun. This is the first installment of our series, The Accountability Index, here on Maryland Morning. We look forward to more conversations, which we basically ask, you know, who's minding the store when it comes to public dollars and public policy? We got more information and a link to the BRU on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up later on today's show, Palestinian pianist Bishara Haroni and Israeli pianist Yaron Kohlberg will join me live in the studio. But first, after a break for news, the monthly Movie Mayhem is upon us. Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post and Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival will have their tips for flicks that you might want to catch this month. It's Maryland Morning. Stay with us. And by the way, here's my tip. Listen to what Mr. Sterner has to tell you.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
And thank you, Mr. Sterner. Good morning again on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Time for our monthly Movie Mayhem. Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post, the film critic from the Washington Post. If you don't get it, you don't get it. Are they still using that?
It's my favorite. Bob Kaiser, bless his heart, came up with that motto, and it is just a classic.
That's right. If you
Isn't
don't get
great?
It, you don't get it. But we get it once
Yay!
A month on the first Friday with Anne stopping by. We're also hoping to hear from Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival in a bit. But Anne, lots of movies to talk about. Lots of stuff out on the silver screens these
Indeed.
Days. There's this new movie, Spotlight, which is about the investigative section of the Boston Globe back in 2001, breaking the story about the Roman Catholic Church and child sexual abuse. Lots of good buzz about this, directed by Thomas McCarthy and written by him and a guy named Josh Singer. What do you think?
I think so very highly of this film. Where do I begin? And full disclosure, the executive editor of the Globe at that time was a gentleman by the name of Marty Baron, who is now the executive editor of the Washington Post. So full disclosure, he is my boss, but I dare say, even if I didn't know the man, I would still go just over the moon for this film. It is an absolute it's just a terrific, well-made, well-written, well-directed, and superbly acted. It's a great ensemble piece about this team of reporters who just, you know, do old-fashioned shoe leather reporting at a time before internet. I mean, you know, the internet was just a mere babe. So we didn't have Google. We didn't have a lot of, you know, you even see them using a spreadsheet, which we find out later in real life was the first spreadsheet they ever used. So it's very analog, procedural about how they run down this story. And the acting ensemble includes Mark Ruffalo, Michael Keaton, Lee F. Schreiber plays Marty Baron.
He plays your boss.
Mm-hmm. And he nails him. It is just a superb, wonderful ensemble cast bringing this story to light in the most restrained but emotional way. I mean, what knocks me out now, Tom McCarthy is one of my favorite filmmakers. He did little films like called The Station Agent, The Visitor, Win-Win.
Oh, I love The Visitor.
All of them. Yeah. Yes, The Visitor is just wonderful. This is, I think, just it just vaunts him ahead in terms of ambition and scope. But he applies the same humanism that he's brought to those projects. He applies the same unerring taste. It is just scrupulously faithful to the repertorial process and, frankly, the filmmaking process in terms of just letting story and character win, you know, take the day. It's just terrific.
And, you know, as things ebb and flow, journalists like lawyers and, you know, public officials, you know, are
That's right. In
esteem, sometimes low in esteem. How does the journalism profession as a whole come off in the light of this movie?
It's gratifyingly, it comes off beautifully. And again, without mythologizing it. And I think, the most recent and obvious comparison is going to be All the President's Men in terms of watching reporters go after a story. But I think this one even resists some of the mythologizing that movie succumbed to, which was great. I mean, it was supposed to be a paranoid thriller, you know, that was very much of its era. And it worked as such. This is not a paranoid thriller. It is a drama. It is just a straight-ahead depiction of events wherein the emotion of the piece really comes from within rather than being imposed in the form of a genre. The Globe itself comes in for some criticism because at first they missed the story, which is a fact that actually the filmmakers discovered when they were researching the script. And they took it to the real guys and said, "Hey, we found out that you could have, you know, reported this years earlier, and you kind of didn't." And they acknowledge that in the movie itself, so they don't come off as just untarnished, you know, valiant heroes. But it does show the quiet heroism. You know, you just had Mark in here from the Baltimore Brew. I mean, this is important work, especially in localities. Daily investigative journalism is so essential for our civic life, and it elevates that just beautifully.
Indeed. Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. It's the Maryland Morning Monthly Movie Mayhem, and joining us now on the phone from Chicago, Illinois, the executive director of the Maryland Film Festival, Jed Dietz. Good morning, Jed.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So you were there celebrating a wedding of your son, Robert. That's going to take place tomorrow, I guess. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Very exciting. I do want to mention, I usually charge $50 to sing You Light Up My Life at weddings. But for you, because we are such close personal friends, $34.99, Jed.
$34.99.
Well, you Tommy. Light up my life. I got to tell you.
And it's going to be right now.
It's going to be right now. I'll tape it for
it's
you.
It's on.
But it's good to have you joining us in the middle of your family festivities. We want to talk. We've been talking about Spotlight, and we're going to talk now about another movie having to do with journalism, Jed. And this is Truth. This is about Dan Rather and the story that ended up bringing his downfall at CBS News. It's about when they reported, discrepancies in the military record of George W. Bush. Jed Dietz, what's your take on Truth?
Well, I haven't seen Truth, so I can't jump in too much on that, and I'll defer to Anne. I want to say, I heard the last part of what Anne was saying about Spotlight, and the one thing I wanted to say from a filmmaking standpoint about Spotlight, which is a truly remarkable movie, is it's one of these instances where the filmmakers totally trusted the facts of the case and found drama in those instead of saying to themselves, well, we'll just recreate everything, who cares? And I think they had those reporters especially Robinson, with them all the way in the process. And they were incredibly well served, and we are as filmgoers too. Yeah. And it doesn't always happen that way, and it's a huge, and everything Ann said is right. It's a hugely important story, because everything that came out about the suppression of the church, the way the church suppressed fact stuff, was really hung on this incredible reporting.
Yeah, and it really is easy, I think, for filmmakers to succumb to the temptation to over-romanticize and over-heroize, you know, some of these figures. And
inject those quote-unquote movie moments. And it's, you know, we will talk about, we can talk about truth in comparison to Spotlight.
Yep.
Because in real life, it shares some DNA in the form of Walter V. Robinson, whom Jed just talked about, who was the leader of the Spotlight crew in at the Globe, but had also investigated that Bush National Guard story himself. And the Globe had been on that years earlier. Truth is a film. It's very stylish. It's very well made. Cate Blanchett plays the producer, Mary Mapes. Robert Redford, I think, even though he doesn't really make an effort to look like Dan Rather, he's captured his voice with uncanny, that timbre and that Texan twang, that subtle twang. Where I think Truth meets its downfall is exactly where Spotlight doesn't, which is it never really, I don't think, it depicts Rather and Mapes as victims and martyrs of this big, bad corporate political culture.
Mapes is Mary Mapes, who's
the producer who was
behind the story.
Right, who had rushed this story to air at the pressure of their bosses at CBS, but still they went ahead and rushed it. And it fell apart. And I think what Spotlight shows is journalistic restraint, where they don't rush a story. You know, they insist upon holding back. And the film itself is restrained aesthetically at the same time and is the better for it. And so you sort of, I wish if I were to have a wish for Truth, it would have been a little bit more self-awareness and a little bit more self-criticism on their part that they did miss the story and they shouldn't have. And
of course, it's based on the memoir about that incident that Mary Mapes wrote.
Yeah, so it's going to be
self-serving. So obviously it's going to be somewhat self-serving.
But I think as a film, you don't have to be self-serving. I mean, I think that's a filmmaking choice. You know, you can, like, just as Spotlight includes some self-criticism, which the reporters themselves didn't have in their book or in their account. You know, nobody knew about it. It was in the archive. So that's a narrative choice. That's not, you don't have to follow that to the letter. And so I think that is a crucial weakness in Truth. But it's a very absorbing, well-made film. I mean, I don't want to damn it with fatal criticism.
Mm-hmm. Jed, how about Brooklyn? Have you seen that one?
I have seen Brooklyn, and it's a wonderful, wonderful movie. I think the John Crowley, the director, interestingly, like another director's movies coming out this week, Room, studied philosophy. He has a great stage career, having directed a lot at Donmar Warehouse in London and Martin McDonagh's plays, The Plowman and stuff on Broadway. What he's done here in Brooklyn is to adapt Emma Donoghue's book. Actually, she wrote the screenplay and tells a story about the process of leaving home, in this case an Irish girl leaving her small town in Ireland to go to the big city.
This is in the 1950s. Yeah.
But
I think, I don't want to jump. Jen, I think you just collapsed Room into Brooklyn. It's the Colm Tóibín film, the Colm Tóibín novel that Brooklyn is based on, not Emma Donoghue.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Nick Hornby wrote the screenplay, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. Thanks.
Other than that, you had it all exactly right, and we appreciate it. And your toast tonight at the rehearsal dinner is destined to be classic, because you're on a roll already here, bro. Let me tell you, that's good. but this is a movie that's getting a lot of really good buzz.
Yeah, it's I thought it was just wonderful.
Yeah, and it's actually going to be there's a sneak preview of it up in Owings Mills on Tuesday night at 7:30 at the AMC Owings Mills Brooklyn.
I'm going to be there, and I've already seen it, but I can't wait to see it. It's just beautiful. Yeah. It's really lovely.
There's this new movie that's directed by involves Juliette Binoche. It's called The Assassin. And I understand that Ann Hornaday, this is also a movie that's getting a lot of buzz.
Right. And now I didn't realize that there's another movie called The Assassin that is not this one that I did see. So I'm going to have to recuse myself on this discussion because I haven't seen the Juliet Binoche one. Sorry.
All right. And of course, I haven't seen it either because, as our listeners know, I have a pathetic life. I never see any movies. I think the last movie I saw was Seabiscuit, for God's sake. So, Jed, I don't know. Have you seen The Assassin?
I have, but I've seen Ho Shio Tien's The Assassin, which is also an incredible movie.
That's the one
A piece of poetry. A Taiwanese filmmaker shot the film, largely shot in China, and it's a lyrical story that's set at the end of the Tang Dynasty.
Okay, so we're talking about the one I did see. So it's beautiful, visually ravishing. I didn't understand one. I think you really do have to bring, the more knowledge you bring of Chinese dynastic history to this, the better off you are. Because I didn't understand 1 minute of it. It's really pretty.
I haven't understood the last minute of our conversation, so now we're all even. That's all good. So we're all on a roll here. All right, how about Suffragette? I have seen the trailer of that one, so I feel like I'm an expert on it. Frankly, this looks very good. This is Carey Mulligan's. It stars Carey Mulligan as Maud Watts, set in the early 1910s in London.
Yeah.
About women taking a stand. Anne Hornady, this is a good one.
Yeah, it's wonderful. You know, it's interesting. Last year we had these movies like Birdman and Boyhood that were really taking all these bravura formal risks, and this year we have this crop of films that are really pretty straight ahead, but just as well made and kind of exhilarating for their classicism. This is a very straight ahead historical drama, filled by a director named Sarah Gavron, like you said, about this particular period in the fight for women's vote in Britain, at a point where their tactics were stepping up a notch and they were getting more into militancy and violence. And Carey Mulligan plays this laundry worker who sort of comes into consciousness and becomes an activist. And, you know, look, the filmmaking, I think, has a few wobbles. I think, there's a little bit of unevenness and a little, some things are not quite as convincing as others. But her performance is one of the great screen performances of this year. I mean, she just... what she is able to convey in one look and one facial expression over a moment, it's just magnificent. And she's ably supported by people like Helena Bonham Carter and the wonderful English actress named Anne Marie Duff, who has done a lot of stage work and I'm a huge fan of, but she just turns in this really spirited, feisty performance. Meryl Streep has a cameo as Emmeline Pankhurst, but really this is Mulligan's movie. And she owns it from the first shot to the last. And if anything, it's worth it just to see that.
Yeah, yeah. Jed, what do you think?
Beautiful.
I haven't seen Suffragette, but I can't wait.
So we've got a lot of stuff to do together here, Jed.
It's a good time to be a moviegoer.
You and I have a lot of dates we got to have. I got to tell you. How about another woman? Sandra Bullock stars in a movie called Our Brand Is Crisis. Now we are getting into the political season, and this is a movie about a political campaign. Sandra Bullock's Scoot McNairy, Billy Bob Thornton, Anthony Mackie, and Ann Dowd. Jed, how about this one?
I haven't seen this one either.
So you have really been planning this wedding pretty seriously, haven't you? Are you doing the flowers for this thing? Is that what's taking all this time? Very good. And you wrote about this,
yes,
I think, right?
Yeah, and this was a miss, unfortunately. It had all these ingredients of being such a timely and potent and pungent political satire. What it wants to be is something on a level of Wag the Dog, which, is really just such a great example of the form. And it doesn't get there. I think tonally it's off. It's based on this documentary that came out a few years ago about the real-life case of James Carville going to consult with a political campaign and kind of bringing American marketing values to another country's political culture. And Bullock kind of plays his role. It's a wonderful role for her, and she's just an awful lot of fun to watch. And Billy Bob Thornton's a lot of fun to watch. But I just don't think they found the right tone or the right story to tell with this one.
And Jed, as we finish up, let's talk about a movie that I know you have seen. This is Room, which is a Canadian-Irish drama thriller. Lenny Abramson, this is the one written by Emma Donoghue, based on her novel. This sounds like a pretty good one, too, as well.
This is remarkable, anchored by one of the great performances on film by a young actress named Brie Larson, who is in a film called Short Term 12 and has been in a bunch of stuff, but that sort of put her on the map for a lot of people.
This is about a mother and a five-year-old son who really are basically confined to this room.
Yeah, the book is revered. I have not read the book, but I would just urge everybody to go into the movie knowing as little as possible about what happens, because the way the filmmaking reveals the situation is really fun to experience. And I would say the other thing is it's an incredibly uplifting story, ultimately.
Right.
Tough to get through, but uplifting.
Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival, Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post, thanks to you both. We will see you next month.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Piano duet Duo Amal includes two hugely talented young classical pianists who have been heralded as among the top pianists of their generation. Bishara Haroni and Yaron Kohlberg have toured the world, and tomorrow night they'll be sharing their artistry at the Gordon Center for the Performing Arts in Owings Mills. But like most of their concerts, musical artistry won't be the only thing they'll be sharing. They'll also be sharing hope. Bishara Haroni is Palestinian. Yaron Kohlberg is Israeli. With tensions in Israel and the occupied territories as high as they have been in years, amid talk of recent violence developing into another intifada, the fact that two artists from opposite sides of the conflict are choosing to perform together is a noteworthy fact on its face. But as important as it is that these artists may be symbols of a peace movement in the Middle East, let's be clear, these guys can play. That's music by Rachmaninoff, performed by Duo Amal. Yaron Kohlberg and Bishara Haroni join me in Studio A this morning. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
So this is the end of a United States tour. How you've been on the road for quite a while. Is it tough touring and, travel, play? Those are long days sometimes, huh?
Yes, it is, but we are quite used to it by now.
Yeah, yeah. So, of course, the tensions, back home for you guys are just at a terrible spot. Just on a Thursday, there was a Palestinian man who attempted to stab a soldier at the Gush Etzion Junction in the West Bank. He was shot dead by the Israeli army. That's reported in the Jerusalem Post. That's yesterday. The Palestinian News Network, interestingly enough, did not report that at all. So there are different takes, different perspectives on these events that are happening. You guys are traveling together. Bishara Haroni, is this a topic of conversation between the two of you? Are you talking about what's going on back home?
Yeah. First of all, the piece we're playing now, it's a Prokofiev Classical Symphony.
Oh, that's right. It's Prokofiev. I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you.
Now, we had many arguments about politics in the past. We figured out everything. We had some problems that we solved with a lot of communication. So this is not something that we talk about often right now. We are more focused about the music.
Mm-hmm. So Yaron, would you agree with that assessment? This is something you've sort of just worked out and gotten past. Do you get past it? Is it possible?
Yeah, of course, we are from the area, so it's always. Originally from the area, we don't live there right now, so obviously it's a part of us in a way. But we ourselves, we managed to, certainly between us and also in general, we already managed to get through this. I mean, we did discuss it quite a lot, mostly about our personal backgrounds. When we just started the duo, and we spoke a lot about the subject, and until the level that we got it to a very good mutual understanding about it.
Duo Amal. Amal is an Arabic word meaning what?
Meaning hope.
Hope, yeah. So this is sort of in the DNA, Bishara Haroni. It's in the fundamental structure of what you're trying to do here, is it not? The fact that, a Palestinian and an Israeli are playing together?
Well, in the beginning, when we started, we thought exactly that way. And now every year we change very fast and we approach things differently. So now we still hope, but we really focus much more on the music.
Here's a little bit more music. This is music of Mozart. So, Jaron Kolberg, you've been together for about 4 years now. You started the duo in 2011. Do I have that right?
That's true.
Yeah. There have been others. Daniel Barenboim quite famously put together an orchestra of Palestinians and Israelis to play concerts around the world. Several other classical musicians have, you know, done this attempt to use the arts to bridge the gaps between the two sides in this conflict. I mean, do you think when you play concerts, are people the reactions that you're getting from people are they indicative of the fact that people are willing to rethink what's going on in the Middle East at this point?
You know, as we always say, we cannot take responsibility of something that, you know, somebody thinks. It's very personal. Of course, that if we can show, or I don't know, if somebody sees us as any sort of example, that's great. But for us, it's really about, it's something personal. I mean, we don't see ourselves as representatives of the area or of the, you know, where we come from. We represent ourselves as musicians, as friends, first of all. And this is our main message, you know, when we go out there and play, we just want to focus on the music and the friendship between us.
And Bashar Haruni, does the friendship that you two share, does that extend to your families, to your mutual network of friends as well?
Yeah, fortunately, yeah, of course. We have very open-minded families and we have very nice friends. So, yeah, it does.
Yeah. How do you all pick your repertoire? There's a bunch of music written for two pianos. Sometimes it's piano four hands where you're both sitting at the same keyboard. Other times it's two separate instruments that you're playing simultaneously. But are you also involved in doing music that's not originally written for two pianos? Like, for example, this Prokofiev symphony that we heard a little bit of in the top of the segment.
Absolutely. I mean, so this is the good thing about this medium. There's actually quite a lot of possibilities. I mean, there's the existing famous repertoire for four hands and for two pianos. There are some things that are, you know, especially transcribed for that. Some pieces, for example, that we play in the concert are pieces that were commissioned by us, you know, by living composers. And now we're also working on having our own transcriptions to some pieces and even songs.
Yeah. And Bashar, there's a unique chemistry when people play together in duos or trios, string quartets, you know, have sort of famous, almost family dynamics. You've been together, you know, 4 or 5 years. How has that chemistry between the two of you evolved over the last few years?
So that's all about it. It's really fantastic. I played many chamber music, and as you know, you are in the field as well. It's not easy to have such a good chemistry between players in the first place, and it works amazing, and it evolved even better.
Yeah, it has improved. I mean,
improved.
I mean, it's kind of like a married couple that's been married for 40 years who can finish each other's sentences. I mean, are you finding musically that you can easily anticipate what the other person will do?
You should come to the concert.
Yeah. Well, I have no doubt that's the case. I definitely should come. Here's a little bit more. That's a little bit more Mozart, I guess. What are you going to play tonight? Tomorrow night.
So tomorrow night is we're going to play one of our favorite programs, which is consisted of the Fantasy for Four Hands by Schubert, the Prokofiev Classical Symphony, transcribed by Rikuya Terashima, Rachmaninoff Suite number 1 and two commission pieces by Avner Dorman and by Samir Odetamimi.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Well, thanks to you guys for coming by, and break a leg tomorrow night. The Palestinian pianist Bashar Haroni and the Israeli pianist Yaron Kohlberg, they are duo Amal. They'll be playing at the Gordon Center for the Performing Arts at the Jewish Community Center in Owings Mills tomorrow night, 8 o'clock. We've got more information about that event on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. You've been listening to Maryland Morning here on 88.1. Nathan Sterner co-hosts, and engineers the program. Rob Civic, John McCone, and Kathleen Cahill produce it with assistance from Scott Seiss. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville keeps us caffeinated. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. Thanks to Chris Kennedy and Clean Cuts Music for our theme song. Coming up Monday morning, I'll speak with NPR's Steve Inskeep about his book on Andrew Jackson, and we'll get his take on the current national political scene. We'll also talk about embattled Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano with the Baltimore Sun's Luke Broadwater, and Nathan Sterner will look into the size of the deer population in Maryland. Speaking of deer, you are to me and to all of us on the Maryland Morning Team. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.